Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we currently talk about whatever books we want. My name is Karen O'Donoghue and I'm alone in the kitchen with an eggplant. Joining me is author and as much smoked salmon as you could possibly want, Ella Risbridger.
Hi.
Hi. Today we're talking about Home Cooking by Laurie Colwyn, a much, much beloved sort of cult book, I would say. A cult food book.
We could call it a cult book.
Yeah.
Because people haven't heard of it.
Unless they have, in which case... And if the people that have are... There's a famous phrase that Brian Eno said about, I think it was The Velvet Underground, and he said 30 people bought The Velvet Underground's first album, but all of those people went on to form bands. And I think Laurie Colwyn and Home Cooking, you could say the same thing. Everyone who read Home Cooking went on to write a cookbook.
This is very true, yes.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi, yes. My agent gave me this book as a signing present. I had never read
really?
It
before.
Really? Yeah.
I had assumed that this was like a formative part of your cookbook writing journey.
Sort of, in that I signed my deal with my agent when I was 21. So, and I think at 21 you're still young enough for things to be formative.
Yes. But, oh my God, I forget that. Yes, I was there. Even I forget how young we were.
We were so young, we were tiny babies. We were young and being formed by things. So it wasn't part of how I learned to write about food, really.
Mm-hmm.
But Daisy, who is my beloved agent, said that I needed to read it. She's like, oh, you and Laurie Colwyn are the same.
Mm. And you are.
We are the
you
same.
Are the same. Yeah.
We are the same. There are lines in here that I'm like, I wrote that.
But I do think there's a kind of a non-linear influence going on in that. I would think that when you first started writing about food, you were kind of looking to Nigella and Nigella had been looking to Laurie to an extent. So would you think that she's kind of a grandmother in a way? Influence-wise?
To an extent, I'm always wary of talking about influences because I don't think... I love Nigella, I think she's a genius.
Mm.
And some of the way she writes recipes, I think, have influenced me. And I think the beginning parts of How to Eat influence me. But I think that the way I write, or the way I try to write anyway, owes much more to fiction. And I think probably it's actually more like that in that Laurie Colwyn, Nigella and I are all coming from English people who have read a lot of English literature.
Yes,
and
yes.
It comes down through the three of us in different ways.
Yeah.
So it's more like we're all just cousins. So there's this...
Yeah, interestingly as well, there's a lot of references in Home Cooking to sort of children's literature and sort of like high teas. And she's got a real fascination with the kind of English child literature that appears a lot in Midnight Chicken as well. Your book, which people don't need to be told about because it was very, very successful and continues to fly off the shelves.
Oh, it was. Yeah. It does. Please keep flying it.
So before we get into anything properly, I'm going to do a little bit of light housekeeping, which is not something I do often on the podcast, because I really hate on podcasts when people talk too much about the business of having a podcast. I think it shatters the illusion.
Whereas I love it. But maybe that's because I'm very new to podcasts generally.
Possibly. I've been doing it for a while, and I think I hear a lot of new people coming up being like, so everyone, we're on a podcast today. Here's my podcast. And I find it off-putting, so I try to avoid it. But nonetheless, here is the housekeeping notes. So while this cheeky old pandemic has been going on...
cheeky little panny D.
Cheeky little panny D. I have sort of suspended normal service with the kind of various different guests coming in with romance novels that they love. And instead, it's just been you and me talking about the books that we just like. Some of them have been on sort of genre. Lots of them haven't been. We've had a great time.
It's been a ride.
I've loved it. And I'm glad.
Me too.
I'm so glad.
I too have had a lovely time.
To have brought you into podcasting. Because like I just remember when we first did one, you were so nervous coming in. And now you're so confident. And it's lovely to watch you blossom.
I love to blossom as a part-time co-host of popular podcast, Sentimental Garlic. Well, go on.
Exactly. And so what we're going to do going forward is that I do want to kind of continue with the normal service in terms of our... restart the normal service, as it were, of people coming in talking about romance they love. But I also really enjoy doing this with you. And and I think we should keep doing it. And so what we're going to do, what we decided to do, is that Ella's going to be somewhat of a part-time co-host, is the title we've settled on.
A lovely title. I'm going to paint it over the door.
and so we're going to do sort of 5-episode seasons every now and then. What I'll do is we're doing 5 episodes of this season, which will be mostly short books. We've decided that people are feeling a bit like knocked down by life at the moment. They need to be doing short books of 200 pages or fewer.
We need short successes. We need easy wins.
Easy wins.
We need things that you can pick up and have a nice time with. Nothing big. We're all bored of big books.
We're all bored of big books. We're all very feeble at the moment.
I can barely lift my wrists.
So last week we did The Virgin Suicides. This week we're doing Home Cooking. In the works we also have Muriel Sparks, The Prime, and Miss Jean Brodie. We're open to suggestions. I'm also looking to pitch you Laurie Moore's Who Will Run the Frog Hospital, but I have to check whether you'll like it first. Because
do
that's
you mean
important.
I have to borrow it from you?
You have to borrow it from me, read it, see if you like it, and then buy it. We'll
I'm open to it. I like frogs. I don't like hospitals, but... That's
everyone should read Who Will Run the Frog Hospital. It's so small and good. And then after this short season is finished, I'll take a break as usual, record some with some other guests, do that for a little while, take another break, and then you'll be back again. So you'll never be more than 2 months from your next Sentimental Garbage episode, listener, which I hope you're very happy about.
I'm happy. I hope they're happy.
We're all happy. Just thought it was important to give some structure because I think I've just been scattershotting episodes of people and they have no idea what's going to come next or why.
Well, they should just be grateful.
They should just be grateful. I do this for free. It makes almost no money.
Hey, but we do get to talk about ourselves and books.
That's true.
Whenever we want.
And every 6 months I get a check for a random sum of money, like £104.
A lovely sum of money.
A lovely sum of money. A dress in Monsoon and a lunch.
What a day that would be.
What a day that would be. All right, I'm going to do a summary of Home Cooking now that we've finished with the housekeeping segment. Finished with housekeeping. Now on to Home Cooking. That's the similarity.
Houses. Homes. Homes. Houses. Houses.
Homes. And really, I don't really have a proper plot summary because there's no plot. It's not a novel. It's very much a cookbook with some essays, but I'm going to try my best anyway.
I don't think it's a cookbook.
We'll talk about that in a minute. So, Laurie Colwyn was a novelist and food writer who sadly passed away in 1992. While many of her books are no longer in print in the UK, Home Cooking continues to be a cult favourite of cookbook writers, from Nigella Lawson to our very own Ella Bloody Risbridger. In this short book, comprised mainly of essays, very vague recipes and no colour photographs, Colwyn is fun, forgiving and firm on the subject of food. So, mainly essays, very vague recipes with very few measurements and no photographs, and yet somehow this is a hit.
It's a perfect book, is the thing. Mm-hmm. I think that's the sort of main thing I need to say to people is the best book about food that has ever been written.
And why do you think that? Someone who reads so many books about food and owns so many and gets sent so many.
What an enormous question. Why do you think the best book is the best book? It's just so nice. I don't want to simplify this, and she's a very competent and beautiful writer, but it's just so nice. It is the nicest book in the world, which makes it sound kind of toothless and anemic to say something is nice, but I think we undervalue nice.
Mm.
I think culturally we've been undervaluing nice. We've been sleeping on nice.
We've been sleeping on nice for a very long time.
It's like, oh, nice. Who wants to be nice? It's like quite a lot of people. It's like, oh, women, you've been too nice for too long. Yeah. Now's the time to get horrible.
It's the classic thing of sort of the miserabilism that pervades culture, isn't it? This thing of like...
What a phrase. I'm so glad you said that on a recording.
Miserable. It's actually a word that Gavin's been using a lot at home, particularly about the graphic artist Adrian Tamin, which I thought was very spicy and cultural of him to say.
Gavin.
I know. I'm going to have him back on the podcast. He's a very good guest. But
Gavin.
This thing of like things being miserable, therefore being worthy because they're about misery. And we're living in a fairly miserable age, I would think, where...
I think we're living in a miserable age.
Yeah.
We were just talking before the podcast about A Little Life and yes. how much I hate it because it is miserable, miserable, miserable. And I know people being miserable can reveal some of the eternal beauty of the human condition, but I don't care. I want things to be nice.
Just want things to be nice. And it's also, it's, you know, it's not an original thing to say, but it's so much harder to make niceness feel meaty. Do you mean?
And meaningful.
And meaningful, which it definitely does in this book.
Yes. It's about the meaningfulness of everyday life, which is such an awful thing to say, really. And I can't believe I just said it. But it is. It's about making small things big things. It's about making things be worthwhile. And obviously this is a thing that, if you haven't read my cookbook, please pause this podcast, buy it immediately. Run, don't walk. Buy it. That will be nice for me. I will get some money, maybe. Mm. And then I'll be rich and happy and we'll all be nice.
We'll all be nice.
But yeah, my book is obviously very much, and I don't want this to turn into a my book podcast, because that would be a bad way to go about things. But my book is very much, here is a small thing that will make you happy in a horrible world. And I feel very similarly about Laurie Colvin.
Mm-hmm.
Although she doesn't really talk about the horribleness of life. Although I think that essay about the homeless women she volunteers with.
Yeah.
I really want to talk about that.
Yeah, let's talk about it in order first. Sometimes I find that when I pick out bits from the middle of the book, I tend to rush from the middle to the end, and then I miss all the lovely beginnings. And I definitely don't want to do that with this book, because the beginning bits are my favourite bits of the whole thing. And also, I mean, just the very first line of this book is absolutely perfect for the age we're currently in, which is, unlike some people who love to go out, I love to stay home. This may be caused by laziness, anxiety, or xenophobia. And in the days when my friends were happily travelling to Bolivia and Nepal, I was ashamed to admit that what I liked best was hanging around the house.
I want to tell you at this juncture that I recently wrote a feature, a very short feature for Waitrose magazine, about Laurie Colvin.
Oh.
I wrote it in March.
Yeah.
I took as a sort of starting point this, I love to stay home, and wrote, this is extremely relevant and will still be relevant. I wrote it for the June issue, and Waitrose, very optimistically, said they thought it would date the essay and took it out. And,
narrator, it did not date it.
Narrator, it did not date it. And we are still mostly indoors, although now you are also allowed in my house.
Yeah, I'm this sitting on your bed right now.
This is our first podcast. We are distanced. Don't worry, guys.
Yeah.
But the first podcast where we've been in the same room.
For a long time, yeah.
It's very exciting. Very welcome back to my bedroom.
It's lovely.
Caroline famously believes that you can't be best friends with someone unless you know what their bedroom's like. She yes. said this maybe 8 years ago, the first time she dragged me into her room to show me her room.
I think we're going to end up referencing that time period a lot, because I did do that, and I do believe that you can't be best friends with someone unless you've been inside their bedroom. I don't care about all of your rich online friendships all of you have. I have them too. But you're not best friends unless you've been in their bedroom, unless you've seen where they sleep and you've sort of like half glance the contents of their laundry basket. You just don't know them. And and roughly around that time, or probably a bit later.
It's a few years later, I think.
A few years later, June 2015.
Oh,
You gave me this book for my birthday. My birthday's actually in May, but it took you a few months to get together, I suppose.
No, it's just that we were in that phase of giving each other large numbers of books.
Yes, and we would. What we would do is we would buy like secondhand books on Amazon that we loved for like 99p, and then we would go through them and highlight them and write in the margins for the bits. It's very romantic and sweet. We did this for about 2 years, and then we got like more busy because it's very time intensive to do that for somebody, like a stack
to
of
read
five books,
5 to 10 of your favorite books, underlining each part you love and explaining why. It's so romantic and tender.
So romantic. So yeah, you probably ordered these books in May, and then it took you a few weeks to.
Well, this one was really hard to get hold of.
Yeah, this is like a kind of an older American edition, I think.
It is.
Yeah.
They reprinted this one in, I think,
1988.
They reprinted this in.
I think it might have even been out of print by the time you were buying it for me. I think that's a new version that you have in front of you.
It says it was reprinted in 2012. Maybe More Home Cooking, which is the second book of her essays, was reprinted in 2015.
But on the front here, you have, "Darling Caroline, I know you don't cook, but if you ever did, start here. Happy birthday, Ella, June 2015. Which I think I find very, very precious. And also, I think, bad advice.
No, it's good advice.
I don't think you should... Because I do cook now a bit more than I did back then. And I don't think I could cook from this book. I think it's too vague. I think some of the food sounds weird, but I still love it.
I think you're right, obviously. Yeah. I think cooking from this book is a nightmare, but I don't mean cook the recipes from this book. I mean read this book to learn why you would want to cook, why cooking would be a thing that would fit into your life, and how... Like, there's this essay about her making bread, and she's like, I tried to make the first bread, and it took all day, and I got my friend to help me, and we weren't allowed to do anything else, and the bread was fine. It was bread.
Yeah, it was as good as, you know, anything from the shop.
And she tries, like, a couple more times. She's like, and the second time was just bad. It was just bad bread, and no one liked it.
Yeah, she actually talks about her failures much more than she talks about her successes.
Which was something I really wanted to do with Midnight Chicken, was to talk more about failures, and we kind of settled on... There's a page at the beginning where the title of the page is Blue Soup. The title of the page is Blue Soup. What a mad sentence. But I really wanted more recipes for things that hadn't gone wrong. And generally, I kind of lost out on the vote of...
Yeah.
People don't want to read about where you've gone wrong. I still think they do.
Because that's my favourite part of this book.
I think it's important to acknowledge that... Cooking goes badly wrong for most people. I am really good at cooking, guys.
She's really good. Believe the hype.
I am correctly hyped for my cooking.
I am appropriately fetid.
I am appropriately fetid for my cooking. And it still goes wrong, even with recipes.
Yeah.
Like Midnight Chicken. The name of my book is Midnight Chicken. I have made the title recipe, Midnight Chicken, literally thousands of times. And... the other week I was cooking in someone else's kitchen and it was horrible. No, it wasn't horrible.
Just wasn't what it's supposed to be.
It was fine. It was a chicken.
Yeah. I think like what you said at the beginning of this, which is that this is why you would start read this book to, I guess, appropriately psychologically place cooking in your mind.
Yes.
Before you begin cooking. I think that is actually the best bit of advice I had to receive this book.
This is how
accept
cooking
failure.
Feels.
Yeah, accept this that it's not going to be... I think everybody knows it's not going to be like Angela. It's not going to be like Nigel Slater. Everyone knows that. But nobody has a configuration. If everyone's been cooked for their entire life by their very capable mothers, and then they're, you know, as I was when you gave me this book, 25, and sort of still kind of living on half-frozen things and not really eating properly.
I believe this was in the era of you sometimes eating lightly warmed microwave mash.
I just love microwavable mash.
You're a pervert, Caroline.
I'm a pervert! The things I have eaten, the things I have put in my body. It was also during the phase where, like, my idea of a treat was just a spoonful of jam and then a spoonful of peanut butter just put in my mouth at the same time.
I love you, but why?
Why
are you so horrible? To be fair, we've got this M&M's chocolate spread, crunchy M&M's chocolate spread.
Oh, yum.
We just keep it in the fridge for eating with a spoon.
Yeah, I think that's fine.
It's so delicious, but it's very hard to find.
I also think that about most sort of like toffee sauces that you find. Like, don't just spoil it with ice cream or biscuits.
I don't want ice cream, it's too cold.
Spoon.
I want spoon of treat.
And I think that's fine.
And I think Laurie Colwyn would agree.
Would agree.
Although she's got very... I would say the bits of this book that feel most dated to me, because it, broadly speaking, doesn't feel dated. It feels... of a New York of the past.
Yeah.
In the same kind of way that Nora Ephron kind of does.
Yeah, it's very hard not to compare it to Nora Ephron, which is difficult because so many things are compared to Nora Ephron.
This genuinely merits
genuinely
the comparison because it's like... Oh.
And they were peers in a sense.
They must have been. They must have been. I think so. I don't really know enough about times of women.
Times of women!
Well, actually, I was thinking about this because there's a... I want to talk about fish because my favourite essay in this book is the one about fish.
Mm-hmm.
I love it more than anything. I think about it all the time. And also, I've just read an essay by Nora Ephron where she says, fish is no fun. Bim, bam, boom, when you're done with a piece of fish. Which I do agree with. But then Laurie Colwyn is very nice about fish. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is a sort of tangent. The point is, I don't want to do down either woman with the comparison.
Yeah.
Because we're all really sick of We're all really sick of being compared to Nora Ephron.
We're all really sick.
You've been compared to Nora Ephron. Yeah. I've been compared to Nora Ephron. This sounds like a humble brag, but it isn't, because every woman writer on the planet has at this point been told by somebody that they're going
to
be a bit like
Nora. If you're writing about contemporary women, then you will be compared to Nora Ephron. It's become a comparison that means next to nothing now. Because it's like, it's one of those things where I think the same slightly about Helen Fielding, who wrote Bridget Jones' Diary, in that the thing that is common to Nora Ephron and Helen Fielding is that they were both journalists who were attached to sort of proper things before they became women's artists, if you know what I mean. Helen Fielding was like a proper correspondent who wrote for lots of important newspapers, and then she had the column of Bridget that then became the book of Bridget. And Nora Ephron was like linked to Carl Bernstein after she was married to him. She was a proper journalist, the youngest female journalist for Life magazine. She had all these credentials. And I feel like the women who write about contemporary female life who are praised and feted are the ones who have super masculine credentials. Liz Gilbert is the same. Like, she was this like roving reporter for GQ for years. And I find that very interesting, that they're the ones that men look at, the ones with the male credentials.
That is interesting.
Yeah, and that's why we all get compared to
women who did actually do something real before they just started writing about themselves. You self-absorbed women.
Yeah, exactly.
Ah, women's business.
Women's business. It's so politicized. I think, you know, we've talked about it so many episodes of this podcast, and I'll never be done talking about it. I think, because I just find it so frustrating and infuriating, but also interesting. But back to Laurie.
Let's start, go back to where we were, which was to say we had got one sentence into the introduction.
One sentence, yes.
I love this idea of staying home. And then she talks about going on holidays and only wanting to visit someone else's house and hang around poking into their cupboards.
Yeah.
My idea of bliss, a vacation at home, even if it wasn't my home. I could wake up in the morning, make the coffee and wander outside to pick apricots for breakfast. I could wander about around the markets, figuring out that night's dinner. In foreign countries, I am drawn into grocery shops, supermarkets and kitchen supply houses. This is me. I am a nightmare to go on holiday with because I do not want to see a single sight. Ideally, I would like to spend the time forging a very tender relationship with, like, the butcher's grandmother. I went to Rome about 5 years ago, about the time that I...
Oh, yeah, I remember
that. Actually, I think I took this book to Rome. I went to Rome. I have seen literally nothing of Rome at all. I was in a nice apartment.
Mm-hmm.
I made very nice friends with the butcher and his grandmother. Mm-hmm. I do not speak any Italian, but we did a lot of smiling and pointing.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of me, like, trying to draw pictures of the thing I hoped to cook. I spent a lot of time looking at different vegetables in the market. It was perfect, but also when people are like, oh, what if we went to Barcelona? It's like, well, you would enjoy Barcelona. I will be in the apartment making friends with a man who sells fish from a box. Which I feel very validated by this.
Yeah, I think...
I feel very validated by Laurie. Reading Laurie Coleman makes me feel like all my choices are validated. I agree with her so much. And maybe if you don't agree with her, it's a different vibe. But for me, a person who loves home cooking and home food and... I don't love fancy restaurants very much. I once did a podcast where they asked me what my favourite restaurant opening of the last year was, and I was like, I do not know, I live in my house.
Yeah.
I live in my house and I eat spaghetti.
I did like one of those like day in the life of newspaper things once or whatever, where somebody asked me my favourite restaurant, and I was like...
I go to my friend Ella's house and see what she's got.
I once read a great tweet that said, I think about all the time, which is the worst thing about having a favourite restaurant is going there for the third time. Isn't that so good? It's like a Laurie Colwyn line, isn't it? Speaking of restaurant food, I think Laurie is really, really good on home cooking versus restaurant food, in that she talks about like trying to make something really impressive and ornate and interesting at home for people. And everyone's like, yeah, good. Well done, you. And like, people want that stuff in restaurants. They want to be wowed in restaurants, or they want to be comforted in a home.
The bit where she's trying to make the stuffing and she says to her sister, I know what I am going to stuff the turkey. And her sister's like, oh, good. And she's like, with cornbread and polenta. Cornbread and pancetta.
Yeah.
And her sister says, I wonder what it will taste like. And Laurie just says, that is the worst thing a cook can hear is,
I wonder what it will taste like.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How interesting. What was that? Is it...
how interesting, what was that? And yeah, she talks about so many sort of like ambitious things that are also like really cheerfully very dated as well. Like the kind of things that like, I was trying to think of, because she's living in this sort of very specific 80s and she's reflecting on the sort of 60s, 70s and 80s of like this world of very competitive home cooking that I don't think exists in the same way now, or certainly doesn't exist in any way I've seen it, of like people making very ornate dishes and sort of torturing each other with them.
Maybe it happens in other places. I think, how many dinner parties do we really go to? Because I say I have a lot of dinner parties, but yeah, what I really mean is I make a pie and we sit on the sofa and eat the pie.
Yeah.
Oh, I miss dinner parties.
Same. Same girl.
Soon. Maybe one day.
But this is the kind of like very, I'm trying to find exactly, it's very difficult to explain what you mean when you mean like 70s food. Okay, here's one. Yam cakes with hot pepper and fermented black beans.
You see, interestingly, I read that and thought, oh, this has come back round.
Oh, really? So you're more aware of food trends than I am.
I feel that this thing of black bean, this feels very like a little bit fusion-y, a little bit using things up. I can see it on, like, simply, what's it called? The food website, Kenzo somebody Lopez? I can't remember. This is irrelevant to people who aren't in the food world. But there are certainly blogs where I'm like, I would read this recipe. Yeah.
How about creamed spinach with jalapeno peppers? That to me sounds fucking disgusting.
It does, but actually once you read it, I'm like, I think a lot of these things are about to come back round. What's interesting for me is the things she says are dated.
Yeah. What does she say is dated?
Oh, I wish I'd written it down. This is the problem with reading things on paper instead of on Kindle. You can't just search.
Mm-hmm.
What she says dated. I think there's a bit where she talks about like people don't like bread, people don't like, oh, the diets.
Yes.
We're on a no fat.
Yes, no fat, no salt.
No fat, no salt diet, which is not a thing you hear about a lot now. Now it's no carb.
Yes, that's so true. Yeah, she's a special chapter just for picky eaters, and she kind of includes allergies and kosher meals, but she also just includes the sort of faddy eating that she's putting up with at the time of writing, which is 1988. And
it's all,
yeah, salt eating, fat eating and stuff. And now, and obviously meat, which is, you know, always a thing, but what are the sort of, people come now with gluten allergies.
Gluten allergies, vegans.
Vegans, yeah. She doesn't even mention vegans in this, I don't think. Oh, does she?
Vegetarians, for example, are enough to drive anyone crazy. Like Protestants, they come in a number of denominations. A very Caroline line, that.
Thank you.
Lacto-vegetarians will eat dairy, eggs, and usually fish. But some lacto-vegetarians will not eat fish. Vegans will not eat dairy product or eggs or fish. And some people say they are vegetarians when what they mean is that they do not eat red meat, leading you to realise that for some people, chicken is a vegetable. And then she goes on to people who keep kosher. And then she goes on to people who can't eat salt. And those, I think, are very... It's very interesting that allergies, vegetarians and vegans, kosher and salt-free diets.
Yeah. But that kind of, I suppose, as you were saying, it feeds back into the very New York-iness of the book, which is some of my favourite bits. And to me as well, the bits of this book that capture the nuances of my 20s more than any other book I've ever read about, like, someone in their crazy 20s is the sort of like specific dowdiness of having no money, tiny, tiny, tiny apartments. And like, there's this bit where she's living in Greenwich Village in the, I think probably the 60s and 70s. And she has this tiny room where she lives alone. She has a single bed. She has a little card table that she can fit four people around it. And then she does all her washing up in her little ensuite bathroom. And she has a little dish dryer that goes over her bath. And it's just so lovely. It's very Miss Honey, you know?
It's quite Miss Honey, but then she's trying to make spaghetti carbonara and she hasn't realised.
She only has two burners.
Yes.
Yeah.
But she has to drain the spaghetti in the bathroom and then run it back to put the sauce on it, by which time the spaghetti's obviously gone a bit cold.
Oh.
It's just gluey. And she's trying to entertain her former boss and his wife.
His wife, who kind of hates her anyway. And she's just sitting there. Like, the wife is just sitting there in this, like, tiny little room, like, you brought me here to eat this kind of thing. And it's a sort of very specific, because when you think about, like, people being young and poor in their 20s, like, you either kind of conjure sort of a party girl image, or you conjure kind of a with nail and eye sort of very masculine, like, chaos. But what you don't see much of is very small, cozy people being
trying very hard, being tiny. For me, is our early 20s.
Yeah, totally.
Yours and mine.
Yeah.
Like, our shared intersection was sitting in my tiny flat.
And it was so tiny.
It was so tiny. I think people think I'm exaggerating when I talk about how small that kitchen was. But you could touch all four walls.
Yeah.
You just reached out and all the walls were there.
Yeah, yeah. And it was like, and I remember there was a time where people would come over a lot and they would like volunteer to clean and stuff very, very kindly. And you would always be like, oh, they've thrown off the whole system, because there were so few cupboards and things were like stacked and ordered in this like very like chaotic from the outside, but actually highly ordered way.
I remember because the only way to get the plates out and to get a saucepan, you had to move the plates forward.
Yeah.
Plates had to be slid to one side, which meant moving all the glasses.
Yeah.
Oh, God, there were no cupboards. There were no cupboards. Stuff everywhere.
Being stuck to the walls as well.
Like, oh, God,
utensils
spices.
Stuck to the walls.
Spices nailed to the walls.
Yes!
There was nowhere else to put spices. And we had a lot of them because we lived over a Bangladeshi supermarket and all the spices were so good and so cheap.
Yeah.
And I had never... We were so young. I was 19 when I moved into that flat.
Yeah.
And... I didn't really know how to make things organised or nice, but I was trying.
Yeah, and just like, and this is the bit with, I really see Laurie's, the whole chapters on her in Greenwich Village with her friends, who she calls the Alices, because they're both called Alice.
They're best friends and they're called Alice.
Oh, there's this bit where you highlighted it for me and it just says next to it, as many of our highlights to each other do, it says
is
us.
It? One of the Alices began to eat the béarnaise sauce with a spoon.
Yes, do you want to read it?
I literally have it written.
There you go, page? There it is.
I had once enjoyed beef fondue. I felt it would be nice to replicate this dish for my friends. I served three sauces, two of which I made. One was tomato-based and the other was a kind of vinaigrette. The third was béarnaise in a jar from the local delicatessen. While we waited, we ate up all the bread and butter. One of the Alices began to eat the béarnaise sauce with a spoon. The other Alice suggested we go out for dinner. Once in a while, we would dip a steak cube into the oil to see what happened. At first, we pulled out oil-covered steak. After a while, the steak turned faintly grey. Finally, I turned one of my burners on high and put the pot on the burner to get it started. Thereafter, we watched with interest as our steak cube sizzled madly and turned into little lumps of rubbery coal. Finally, I sautéed the remaining steak in a frying pan. We dumped the sauces on top and gobbled everything up. Then we went to the local bar for hamburgers and french fries.
Mm. This is so... That, to me, is everything. I feel like I might as well have been there, because that was exactly how we lived our lives for so
long.
One
of the Alices began to eat the béarnaise sauce with a spoon.
That's me.
I just remember, like, constantly just, like, hitting the back of your hands away from, like, complex ingredients where I was trying to cook something complicated.
Yeah, I mean, just, like, grating parmesan.
It wasn't even that complicated. It was just, like, spaghetti bolognese, but I was a child.
Yeah.
I was 20.
Yeah.
And we were all... quite hungry.
All the time starving. All the time. And like, yeah, I remember just being so in awe, because like nobody else I knew how to cook or set or tried to, really.
And I tried really hard.
So you were so hard, and you were like so much. That's why like Midnight Chicken is still such a sentimental time for me.
Are we both gonna cry?
Maybe. But like, I remember when you made your mac and cheese, which I don't think made it into the book, but was on your blog, with had walnuts in it, and I remember being there being like, who thinks of this? And like, and the also it was the most delicious thing I've ever had in my entire life, and I remember the feeling of eating that off of a spoon from one of a white tin enamel cup and just being like, this is the best.
Just making it and never having the right crockery. That's the other thing I love about home cooking, where she talks about...
the things you don't need as well.
Oh my God, the bit at the beginning where she's like, you can do most... You don't need a food processor. You just need some bits.
Yeah.
But when she's alone in the kitchen with an eggplant, which is what I think this book was originally called, or like it's her most famous essay.
Oh, really? It feels like some of these essays were probably serialised at some point, didn't they?
Oh, okay. Lots of them were in the paper.
Okay.
But yeah, she used to... I uncovered the eggplant, cooked it down and ate it at my desk out of an old meissen dish with my feet up on my wicker footrest. And like, it's just a fancy dish that she just eats her lonely dinners out of. And I find that very charming. Because we ate... When did we get matching plates in that flat? Not until really near the end.
Your table had three legs.
It did, and it was a big stack of books. With
something else, yeah.
Well, what we had was too many books, and they'd collapsed the wall shelves. So then what we had to do was put all the books underneath the books on the table to hold up the shelves.
Hold up the shelves, yes.
And so nothing could be moved. No books could be moved.
Yes.
If you did want a book that was structural.
Yeah.
And you had to get someone else to come and hold up the shelves for you while you did a switcheroo.
Yes. And three people could sit at the table, but not four. And so if there was another person over, everyone had to eat off their laps on the couch.
And the couch was a fold-out couch.
Yeah.
In fact, sleeping on. Which for some reason, which when folded out, took up the entire floor space.
Yeah.
Of the room.
Couldn't walk. Yeah. Very nice time. It's a very lovely time. And you had, like, parties in there. Like, you had a yearly curry party there.
Like 25
people. 25 people, yeah.
There was no room.
Sitting on the floor, yeah. I've met some of my best friends on that floor.
I just remember you and Tessa.
Yeah, I met Tessa for the first time properly
sitting
on that
under the
floor.
Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And literally, when we say under the Christmas
sitting
tree.
Under the Christmas
shoulders
tree.
Shoulders in. But I think that's very, very home cooking. And we're just trying.
Just trying.
Just having a go.
Yeah, and I think what people remember so much about this book as well is that, yes, it's about the food, but it's also so much about being in the kitchen, who's in the kitchen with you, who's talking to you while you're cooking, who you're bringing it to, who does and doesn't like this kind of thing, you know? And,
yes.
Like, it's such a... And, like, that's the whole sort of MO of the book is, you know, one of the delights of life is eating with friends. Second to that is talking about eating. And for an unsurpassed double whammy, there is talking about eating while you're with friends. And so it's like, it's not really so much... These, unlike most other cookbooks I think you'd find, they don't really... to correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the expert in cookbooks and I'm not, but like most of the meals in a cookbook exist in a kind of hermetically sealed bubble with maybe a nice foreword being like, when I get in from such and such, I eat so and so. And for me, whenever I flick through a cookbook, which is fairly rare, it's like, it feels like, okay, that was added later through with the help of some post-its. But whereas none of these recipes, and I'm not really interested in most of them, they don't feel like they exist in a hermetically sealed bubble away from the world. They just feel like part of the landscape of this like life that you love being in with her, and you love just being with her while she cooks. And she's got this thing where, like your Nora Ephron's, she's very scrupulous. Like, she's very definite about what she thinks is good and what she thinks isn't good. But she's simultaneously, much more so than Nora Ephron would be, very forgiving. And there's nothing she won't forgive in this book, you know?
On the back of mine, my edition, it says, Laurie Colin's food thoughts are like phone calls from a dear friend.
Yeah.
And that's how you want a recipe to feel, or at least the way I try to write them and the way I try to write my own books, is to feel like you're in the kitchen, like with the phone between like your ear and your shoulder, being like, hang on. So I've done what now? And now I need to stir what?
Yeah.
My friend and yours, Kate Young, mm-hmm. who has been on this podcast,
yes.
I talk to her nearly every day while I'm cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often it is just a series of instructions. Like, Kate, I think it's going to split. I think it's going to split. What do I... And she's like, put the phone on loudspeaker on the table. You need both hands. I'm like, but I don't want to, because then... She's like, put it on the table. Stir. And like, we give each other these small instructions that feel very like being... And for me, that is very much the same experience as reading home cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Is lots of discursive chat, lots of, well,
yeah.
Here is a thing that is completely unrelated to food. It's like when she's talking about feeding the multitudes, which is an essay in this book about, as you can imagine, feeding lots of people at once. And she starts off talking about her parents. Each year, my assimilated parents gave a Christmas Eve buffet with turkey ham, three hot dishes, salad, petit fours, fruitcake, champagne punch with peaches, eggnog, and chocolate-covered orange peel with black caviar for an hors d'oeuvre. Which is amazing.
Mm,
I want to go to this brunch. Why am I not throwing Christmas Eve brunches?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I not throwing Christmas Eve
this
brunches?
This year, maybe.
Well, it's because everyone leaves town. We need 5 more years to get everybody settled into London
That's
and
true.
Staying. Anyway. And then at college, she and my friend Michelle Rice and I were paid cigarette money to make dozens of tuna fish and cheese sandwiches to feed young ladies after curfew. She talks about making industrial cans of tuna fish with huge industrial mayonnaise, which I think is very nice. And then feeling. And she sort of goes through all of these...
All the times that she's made food for lots of people, yeah.
And the Olivieri Centre for Homes... Oh, here's one of the things that's dated. It is now fashionable to run down the 60s. When was the last time anyone ran down the 60s? Everyone loves the 60s. The 60s are the last time people were happy.
And
but, you know, and she's talking about the homeless women that she volunteers with. Mm-hmm. They were and are the most surprising group of people I've ever encountered, and not a single assumption can be made about them except that they were all living in a horrible way. And it's this kind of... Then you get this really three-page-long diversion on...
Nothing similar could be said about them except they were living in a horrible way.
Yeah.
It's such a brilliant...
Brilliant and important thing to keep reminding yourself.
Yeah.
And you get these diversions, but discursions rather, not diversions. You get these discursions on cooking and, you know, these ladies and what she did. And I think my absolute favourite part is... I got the brilliant idea to make an Irish dish called Corcannon, a mixture of spring onions, cabbage and mashed potatoes. The result was not a success, and one of my favourite ladies who wore fuzzy sweaters, beads and had a voice like Lauren Bacall came up to me and said, "Lunch today, honey. A disaster."
I love that as well. And like, because what I love about this chapter, because a big part of it is about her sort of her volunteering, and generally hearing about anyone's volunteering is like, okay, here's a bit where you sort of subtly try to communicate what a great person you are, kind of thing. But it never becomes that. It's always just like very, I don't know, you never doubt her intentions in telling you. And
she's telling you it because it's a story that you want to know.
Yeah, totally. And it sort of maintains the sort of humanity of like, yeah, she was cooking for like women who had nothing, but it doesn't mean that those women didn't have tastes, likes and dislikes. It's like she brings that sort of humanity to it without pushing too hard off that door, you know?
Yeah.
Which I really admire and really like.
It's a bit about one of the women was a person who was waiting for a transsexual operation and therefore was not allowed in either the men's or the women's shelter. She or he, wearing mules with pom-poms, lived for a while here.
Yeah.
And I just find it very interesting that it's like these are not new debates we're having about...
I also found that very, very interesting.
Well, these are not new things we're having about trans people. These are not like...
Yeah.
It's like, well, what will happen if we start being nice to trans people? Well, people will be able to go to homeless shelters and not have to go to the one place in New York that will let them eat some industrial spaghetti.
And like, obviously, I think there's like... So you could react to that paragraph, and it was written in 1988, or some of these essays were printed even before that, so I don't know when it was written. And like the way she says, oh, he or she, you know, could be viewed in a kind of a deadnaming or a disrespectful lens. But I think what Laurie Colwyn is looking at is just like, this is it is ridiculous. And it is ridiculous the way that... And I had a really good conversation with you about this recently enough. And when people talk about like... People, when they talk about trans issues, they always hold up this straw man debate of what about the women's shelters? What about these women who are traumatized by penises or whatever, and by people who live in you know, assigned male at birth bodies? And the answer to that is not, let's decide who gets thrown on the street. The answer to that is, let's get more funding for places that rescue vulnerable people, you know?
And to be able to have discussions and to be like, I have never met a trans person who wouldn't have a conversation.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't... Every trans person I know is so thoughtful and respectful of
They've
other people's...
They've thought about everything. They're the smartest people you'll ever fucking meet.
About... Like, so smart about gender. So many... And I do think it's sort of important for us to have these conversations on the podcast because, as you know, I think a lot about kind of silences... complicity, particularly in UK feminism at the moment, and I know we're staying away from Laurie Colwyn, but hey, why not take 20 seconds to make it clear that trans exclusive feminism is something I find personally extremely troubling,
very troubling,
and I don't like it,
and I don't think it's feminism.
I just think it's
a hard take.
I think it's a bad take to tell people what they should do because of their bodies.
Yeah,
I think we should not throw people on the streets.
Yeah.
Imagine that. But...
Hard same.
Anyway, I think Laurie Colwyn's making the same point. Therefore was not allowed in either the men's or the women's shelter.
Yeah.
I feel like... But it's interesting that these are not new...
This is the conversation that people have been having.
And I think often it is framed as being a new problem. And I don't know.
I think all that happens is that the subject goes out of vogue for a while and then it comes back.
But trans people continue to exist.
Yes, and always
the whole time.
And I like about the chapter as well where she's like, you never feel too bad about not volunteering as much as Laurie Colwyn, because she says at some point she's like, and then I got pregnant and then I never went back, and then after a while I started cooking at my kids' school.
Very nice school.
Yeah. And you know, I just like how she's just never going to make you feel bad about yourself, Laurie Colwyn, even though she does very noble things like bakes her own bread and volunteers at shelters. I never feel like she's a better person than I am.
No, because she's not doing it all the time. She's not like, I'm a noble person who is...
Yeah.
She just does what she does.
She does what she does. I really, really love her bit towards the end where she talks about the value of bad meals. Like the ideological, philosophical value of bad meals. Let me try and find it.
Is this Repulsive Dinners, a memoir?
Repulsive Dinners, a memoir. And it ends with, it talks about all the horrible meals she's had and that she's cooked for people. Because you are the better for your horrible meal. Fortified, uplifted and ready to face the myriad surprises and challenges in this most interesting and amazing of all possible worlds. And she has this thing where she comes home from a horrible meal where it's so disgusting. It's like this kind of variation of like stargazy pie, which is that Cornish pie with the fish with the head sticking up, but it's done with squid. And she talks about just coming home and making potato rosti for herself. And she's got a recipe basically for when you come home and you're knackered and you're sad because you had a horrible meal and you eat something filling and buttery and delicious before you go to bed so you don't resent your hosts forever. And then there's just like this nice simple recipe for potato rosti.
I just love the line for this. As appears to be traditional with me, a large pizza was the real end of this grisly experience. But every once in a while, an execrable meal... Execrable? I don't know how you pronounce that
Execrable.
Word. Execrable. Meal drags on way past the closing times of most pizzerias. You straggle home starving, exhausted, abused in body and spirit. Also, I love any recipe that starts with, take off your coat.
Take off your coat. Love it.
Things like chicken salad, which is the next recipe in the book, which is why I've just jumped from horribleness to chicken salad. No one eats chicken salad anymore.
I was thinking that. I was trying to think of the last time I'd eaten a chicken salad.
Oh, there's lots of mayonnaise in this book.
So much mayonnaise. And like lots of advice to make your own mayonnaise, which you never hear of people doing anymore.
We live in very different worlds.
We live in different worlds.
I live in worlds where the only mayonnaise that people talk about is, oh, I made it myself.
Oh.
With a yolk and a drizzle.
I forget about the places where our lives separate.
Only one.
Only one.
What's happening here for the people listening at home is we're both now reading Home Cooking
silently in company. I'll cut the silences. Which fine.
But I think there's something very telling about a book where both of us have a copy of it in our hands. Yeah. And what we would ideally like to be doing is just
reading and sighing.
Reading and sighing and being like, oh, do you remember? That was nice.
I love how there's two separate chapters on kitchen disasters. One's called Kitchen Horrors and one's called Disasters. And this bit I really like. My own greatest disasters have been the result of inexperience, overreaching, intimidation, and self-absorption. And the thing of, like, bad cooking is as the result of, like, basically low self-esteem, of, like, trying to impress people with things that are just ridiculous.
I love this chapter because now that I'm more accomplished, I feel that I am in a position to gauge my kitchen disasters and choose them carefully. For my next, I am either going to make Circassian chicken, poached chicken blanketed with a walnut puree, or a chocolate jelly roll, which my sister assures me is a snap to make. I have never cooked either of these things before, but instinct tells me that the possibilities for something going terribly wrong in either case are endless.
I love this!
I can feel why both of these things can go wrong. I couldn't explain to you why they must go wrong, but I can feel it.
Oh, she has an instinct for things are going to go terribly wrong, and she's going to do it anyway. It's just so nice. And like this thing of... And as you said to me, way back in 2015, the reason why this is a place to start is that because I remember very, very clearly, I tried to bake a cake once many years ago. And I think I've told you about this cake many times because I remember telling you on the day I made it, saying, I feel like I understand people who have clinical depression for the first time.
Was this in the days where we mainly communicated by Facebook Messenger?
Yes, yes, it was.
I remember the, I remember it well.
Yes, and I wanted to make, I was feeling kind of low and I wanted to make a really delicious, nice thing. And I was like, I'm going to make a red velvet cake because I love velvet cakes. And then I went down to the shop and I bought like the most expensive cream cheese and all this great stuff. And then I couldn't find red food dye, but there was blue food dye. And I was like, oh, a blue velvet cake, like Elvis. Cool. That's great. Blue suede shoes. Fantastic. And then obviously not seeing that, like, what a red velvet cake is chocolate cake dyed red. And when you have a chocolate cake that you try to dye blue, it comes out slate grey. And so not only was it like not cooked all the way through, because I'm just very bad at baking in general, it was also grey. And I'd spent all afternoon and £25 on this whole experience. And at the time I was earning maybe 16 grand a year and I was so upset.
Well, you know what? It's something I feel a real responsibility about when I'm writing recipes.
Yeah.
It's this sense of, and I don't, it's something I have to kind of consciously remind myself of now. Now that I am a grown-up who does a shop and has more money and can just sometimes get a takeaway if it really goes wrong. Yeah. The stakes are less high for me now.
Yeah.
And like, I'm pretty confident I can salvage most things. But I have to remember, and I, this is the place where Midnight Chicken came from, that feeling of, well, that's the money.
That's the money, yeah.
That's the money and the food. This is the game. And I feel, it's why I get so cross when there are some cooks and chefs whose recipes I think have not been really rigorously tested.
Mm-hmm.
When I see a recipe and I think, that can't possibly work, and why I respect so much the recipes that have been obviously tested to within an inch of their lives.
Yeah.
Because you are playing with people's lives. You're playing.
You are playing with people's lives. It's very well put. You are
uniquely privileged in the world of writers to be physically affecting what people are doing with their money and their time.
Oh my god, both I've never thought of this way.
I find it a huge responsibility.
Yeah.
Because, and it's why I try very hard to reply to people when they're like, this went wrong. Mm. Because I feel this sense of, you are trusting me to make this day okay. Yeah. You are trusting me to, with this thing that can completely ruin your day if it goes wrong.
Completely ruin your day, yeah.
And I said at the beginning of this podcast, I recently made this chicken that went, mm-hmm, it was fine. It just wasn't Midnight Chicken. It was like, it was an okay roast chicken.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't that good. I was so sad.
Yeah. It really makes you so upset and depressed.
I have made that chicken 1 million times. I was cooking it for somebody who is in no doubt about my cooking skills. I am in no doubt about my cooking skills. It made, as I say, I'm in a financial position to be like, fuck it, getting a takeaway. Mm-hmm. Who cares? But the actual tears in my eyes at the waste of time and effort. I had been to Sainsbury's. I had to put a mask on because this is the world now.
And you feel like such a lesser person when you fuck up a meal that way. You feel like you're bad at everything. Yeah.
And I feel like that's why it's important to have people like Laurie Colwyn, and why I want to give it to everyone who's starting to cook, to say, well, you won't believe how badly and often things go wrong.
How badly and how often. Yes.
And why I feel this big responsibility when writing a recipe to test things over and over again. And to give, frankly, too much detail.
Mm.
My recipes are very detailed. In a way that sometimes now I'm like, why? So I've just read the audiobook for Midnight Chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And reading it now, this is like, why have I bothered to spell this out? Why have I bothered to spell out how to chop this carrot?
Yeah.
And it's because I wrote it from a place of having just learned to chop a carrot.
Yeah, yeah.
I wrote it from a place of getting a cookbook and being like, diced carrot, eh? I guess it means to the size of dice?
The size of dice!
Does it need to be all square? Yeah. Or just a, like, is this a ruler job? Is this gonna, do I need a ruler and a scalpel, or can I just...
Yeah, this is my big thing of, like, Laurie says this as well in the book, of, like, this whole thing, this myth of, if you can read, you can cook, because, like, not taking into account this thing of lots of cookbooks have a shorthand that is totally alien to people who don't cook every day. And it's like, when it's like, add water to cover. I'm like, what? How much, though? Like, until... Like, cover it and then what? Like, that whole... There's so many linguistic things where I was just cooking that I found so confusing, which is why the only person that's taught me how to cook is you.
I've loved teaching you how to cook.
It's been lovely. I feel like a much better person for it, but I don't think I would have been able to do it without the help of you.
Well, and you have to want to learn to cook, and you have to be taught to cook by somebody who wants to cook in the way you want to cook.
Yes.
Because she talks in this about the loveliest scrambled eggs I have ever had were given to me by a not crazy young man, an English man who insisted that scrambled eggs should be made in a double boiler. The result is a cross between a scrambled egg and a savoury custard, and if you happen to have about 40 minutes of free time someday, it is certainly worth the effort. Stir as in boiled custard until you feel either that your arm is going to fall off or that you are going to start to scream uncontrollably. It's perfect.
It's so good.
But, like, she acknowledges, if you have 40 minutes...
this is a faff, and she's very quick to say, this is a faff and don't bother if you can't be bothered.
Yeah. Recipes are really hard. Recipes are very, very difficult.
Yeah. I think that's what people, when people react badly to cookbooks, it's because they presume a kind of an ease. And when you, when a very confident cookbook writer is like, tra-la-la, just do this, this, and this, and then everything will be lovely, you do feel... I do think people often feel very judged by cookbooks in that way, because they feel like they're such a bad student, you know? It's that sort of bad, messy, scruffy person at the back of the class who's getting everything wrong.
And because and there's a possibility for becoming actually messy and sticky and making your house messy and sticky.
For no reason.
There are such high stakes involved.
Yeah.
And I know that's ridiculous to say about food, but they are high stakes. Most of the time, the high point of the day... is one of the meals.
Yeah.
Most of the time, the thing you're like, oh, but at least there was my delicious Pret sandwich.
Yeah.
At least there was some tea and biscuits. At least there was my fancy four-course dinner. Although, four courses. That's the other thing about this book that feels dated to me, is the number of multiple-course dinners.
Yes, people coming over for multiple-course dinners, yeah. Whereas now, it's like people come over for some crisps beforehand, and then big main, and then maybe a Chapois dessert.
Well, that's what interests me. I wonder whether... Readers, please write in. Whether in other places and in other social groups there are still people cooking
courses.
Big courses
yeah.
for dinner. I find no joy in cooking multiple course dinners. At all. I love to cook. I like cooking at most two courses.
Yeah.
I get nothing out of the idea of here is a four-course meal of which I have had to make every course. Mm. It makes me feel so tired. And all I can think about is the washing up.
Yeah. It's insane. I can't imagine anyone doing that outside of a restaurant. It's insane.
There's an amazing bit where she's talking about... in the old days, women planned dinner parties by sitting down with the cook and discussing what might be nice to serve. The cook or the cook's servant did the shopping. The table was set by the scullery maid. The hostess's job was to dress well and smile, and the husband poured the room. Then, while the men smoked cigars in one room and the women gossiped in another, and the table was magically cleaned and everything was washed and put away. Nowadays, everyone works, and the hostess usually spends a few days on and off consulting with the cook, a replica of the hostess, at 2 o'clock in the morning when she can't sleep. The cook's servant, another twin to the hostess, does the shopping on the way to or on the way home from work, and the butler, a double of the husband, buys the wine and some flowers. The cook and the butler rush home, set the table, start the meal, and just as they collapse exhausted with a glass of wine, the guests arrive.
And, like, I do get the feeling, and, like, I know we've brought her up a lot already, but there is this thing, similarly in Heartburn as well, where you do get the sense that particularly this kind of New York 1970s, 1980s crowd of people were desperately cooking a huge amount and desperately trying to impress one another. Like, I do think that this is a very specific thing that has faded out of fashion. I'm trying to think of my parents had dinner parties. They definitely did. And I think there was multiple courses.
Mine did with multiple courses. But they also had lots of people back from the pub on like a Friday night. Like they would go to the pub with their friends on a Friday or a Saturday night, and then like three or four couples would come back and they would eat a curry.
Yeah.
Like sometimes something else, but mostly they would eat a curry. Occasionally someone else would bring dessert. Their dinner parties where it's like the table is laid.
Yeah.
My mum is having a bath and she smells like Chanel No. 5.
Yeah, mum's wearing a black dress.
Is there anybody more beautiful than your mother when you're seven?
So amazing,
and she's wearing
isn't
perfume.
It makes you're so in awe and so afraid. Because you're like, she's going to leave us forever? Why would she stay? She's so glamorous.
That's exactly how I remember thinking. I'm just like, wow.
Wow, she's amazing.
She's the most beautiful person I've ever...
And, like, that thing of... We've talked about this a lot before, but, like, that thing of when she comes back from somewhere and her hair smells all cold and, like, night and, like, perfume. It's, like, the best feeling in the world.
Do you know what? I think this is a lovely segue into talking about... So much of this book is about her young daughter.
Yeah.
Which is so sad when you think that she died 4 years after this book was published.
Yeah, so young, 48.
So young. But there is so much love there for her daughter. And when she's talking about her daughter eating the fish, and I'll never forget my daughter's delighted expression of delight and surprise the first time she ate a zucchini.
Yeah, zucchini flowers as well.
It's the most delicious.
And she talks about as you get older and your palate matures, and then watching her daughter like taste like smoked salmon for the first time, and like seeing her eyes light up and being like, oh, that's what I like when your palate is clean.
And then and when she talks about eating this meal that made her laugh because it was so delicious.
Oh,
I've had meals like that, and it's always just like, how can this be? I ate an apple once when staying with Kate Young in the countryside, and she's like, this tastes like apples. This tastes like an apple. And there's one of my favourite sentences in all food writing, which I'm going to read now.
Mm.
You're going to listen.
I'm going to listen.
Which is from the essay Fish, which I love and has been largely what we've been quoting from in this last bit of this podcast. Part of the experience of being a parent is the re-experiencing of your own childhood. And as I watch my daughter taste her first this and that, which in New York City means her first shiitake mushroom, falafel, plate of hummus, tree ear, bamboo shoot or chocolate mousse, I remember back to that time when my palate was clear and unsophisticated. Everything was an adventure and the world was as fresh as a fish.
Mm. Nice.
The world was as fresh as a fish. And I think it's really interesting that we have spent most of this podcast talking about that time, 5 to 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
when we were kind of first in London and first trying things and trying to be these people that we are now.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously we're kind of continuing to evolve and things change all the time and every day something new happens. But basically we were trying to get here, right?
Mm.
And just cooking our things with our rubbish cooking, and you just always...
I mean, my cooking was rubbish. Your cooking was always superb.
It was quite good. It was quite good. But it was always... There were a lot of pots and pans involved. Yeah. There was so much butter.
Yeah, so much butter.
I just put butter in everything. I mean,
I always remember this one dessert that you made that was ripped up donuts and custard.
That I wrote about this in the book because it was the worst. It was my big culinary disaster. You ate it anyway.
Me and Harry ate it. Like,
it
was mad. It was supposed to be quite tasty.
It wasn't. It was horrible. It was supposed to be a donut bread and butter pudding, an idea I still think has legs.
Donuts. And what it was just like a bag of donuts from Sainsbury's.
They should have been torn up, and then the custard should have kind of soaked into them. Mm-hmm. What happened was it turned into a sort of sweet scrambled egg.
Yes.
With donuts floating in it. And I wanted to put it in the bin, but Caroline...
You were so upset, and then you were like... You could tell you were like almost sort of on the brink of crying, and
well,
you were just like
welling up. It's such a waste. Hard.
But then me and Harry were just like, well, we're having a great time.
Harry Harris. Jingle this podcast. Yeah. God, we've just been friends for ages.
We've always been friends for ages, and it's lovely. And I hope everyone hasn't found this too self-indulgent, us talking about our friendship, but I hope it reminds everyone of their sort of like dowdy, try-hard 20s.
The dowdy 20s. That's the thing. Where you're just trying to be a person.
Here's the thing. I've read a lot of books, a lot of great books, about people who had very like sexy and adventurous 20s. And I love them. They're great. But my late teens had a bit of sex and adventure. My early 20s were mostly being very poor, eating shit clothes, wearing shit clothes, eating things that were too nice for for where I was in life.
Just sitting in that grubby little flat.
Yeah.
Always in the dowdy clothes. Being like, well, our sex and adventure years are behind us. We've left them behind in our late teens. Yeah. And now in our early 20s. We will try and make something nice.
This is something I am obsessed with. That period that you enter into in like age sort of like 20 to 24, when like all your sort of teen sex appeal, you lose faith in it completely. And you're sort of that sort of like confidence you found as a kind of a upper sixth sort of whatever. And it's just kind of complete. And then you're just like interning or you're just assistant work or whatever. And all of your clothes are from TK Maxx, but like from... like, but bad TK Maxx, do you know what I mean?
The weird ranges.
Weird range. Like, always.
And you've got no taste.
All, here are the colours I wore. Emerald green, like dark burgundy. Emerald green, burgundy, navy. Always like with weird prints
jewel
of
tones.
Like, jewel, and jewel tones.
Why were we wearing jewel tones?
Just very, like, literally the things that a woman who was like organising like a Macmillan coffee morning would wear.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
But if you're 23, it's weird.
It's baffling. It's a brief period in the lives of many young people where they just need to be grown up.
Yeah, but they overshoot the runway.
You're just trying to work out, but you're trying to work out what it means to be a grown up and what it means to have friends and what it means to be a person. And like, she talks in this book about how people don't really learn to cook anymore because everyone has jobs.
Yeah.
And what that means is at some point in your late teens or more realistically early 20s, you have to start trying and being like, what do grown ups eat? What do we feed each other as grown ups?
Yeah. Because when you're a teenager, it's very much like, I always think about this as well, that meal, when you're a teenager, when you come home and that few hours before anybody else gets home, like your parents get home or whatever, and you make yourself your thing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yours was horrible.
Mine was turkey rashers under the grill, and then in a sandwich with lots of ketchup.
I thought yours was pot noodle in a sandwich.
Oh, no. Pot, okay, no, super noodles. Curry super noodles on a bagel with peanut butter, a toasted bagel with peanut butter. It's great.
It's horrendous.
It's great. What was your
I don't know. Because I just used to get cheese bread on the way home.
Cheese bread?
Cheese bread. It's like a Lebanese thing.
Oh, right. And I grew up in Dubai, everyone.
It was just like, it's the most delicious thing in the world. I think its proper name is like manakish, but it's like, imagine a pita that's kind of softer and pillowier. And on the top of it is this cheese. You can't get it in England, but it's kind of like a combination of... Imagine halloumi, but it's mozzarella.
Oh, wow.
It's very salty and soft, and I used to put extra salt and pepper on it. And then it's folded in half. And then, if you're me, you microwave it in the school microwave. Because you've got a microwave in a kettle, don't worry about it. Got a microwave in a kettle in the common room. Don't even...
Well, only we can use it.
Not anyone younger than us.
Perfect. I think we should leave it there because we've been talking for a long old time.
You can cut it down. Maybe you won't.
So we're going to be continuing with short books this series. We're also going to do one bonus episode on Scenes of a Graphic Nature, which is my novel that is out now.
Is out now?
I mean, it's out. Well, when this episode goes out, it'll be out.
Oh,
that's how time is.
Ah, time.
So everyone, please buy that and read it so you can enjoy us talking about it.
What fun!
And this has been a long advertisement for Midnight Chicken as well as home cooking, so buy that too.
Please buy that. It's a long time since I've done a plug for Midnight Chicken. Please do buy my book Midnight Chicken. I hope you really like it.
You will. Bye.
Bye.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast, thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.